What a pleasure for me. Now, I've been feeling the whole time I've been here in Louisville like the country cousin. I live out in the mountains, you know, in Vermont, and our Rotary in our little town meets at Rosie's Diner, but it's 7 in the morning, so, you know, this is an altogether more alert crowd than I, you know, we usually see Rotarians. But of course, the things that unite Rotary meetings are more important than the things that divide them. I've been going to Rotary meetings for a very long time because my grandfather was the president of the Rotary in his small town, where he was also the mayor and the only doctor. And through time, they are very much the same, and across distance, very much the same. As I travel around the world doing this global climate organizing, one of the places we often end up are at Rotary meetings, or often also Rotaract meetings, the youth organizations so prominent in some parts of the world. And so I've been in wonderful meetings in Mumbai, or in, you know, just in many of the biggest cities and farthest flung places in the world, and you all would feel right at home there, the same spirit very much animating those meetings of service and of civic pride. Louisville, however, is a very special place, and just these last few days have been such a pleasure to help kick off this Festival of Faiths. Last night at St. Stephen's was a remarkable time. What a beautiful church that is, and what remarkable music and preaching we heard. And again, I felt a little intimidated. I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher in a little tiny church, so it was, you know, more splendor than I was used to, and a much more powerful organ. But it was very good to be there. And then to get to spend time, a few hours this morning, with 300 or 400 students from around Louisville, from high school students who were eager to go to work on particular climate plans for their own schools and figuring out how to make conservation really work quickly, and that sort of thing, was great fun. And to know that that work will continue, to see some of my colleagues from Middlebury College here and know that they're working on these internships around sustainable agriculture and things, real opportunities opening up in new ways. It's also been my great fortune to get to be the guest last night of Christy Brown and of her family, and to be reminded what civic and corporate leadership at its best looks like, and also to see, in the face of her loss this year, a community rallying around, and to have some sense of what that kind of kindness and generosity is like. And it was really, really nice to see. Now I'm going to be just the tiniest bit sterner with you for just a minute, because the night before I had the equally great pleasure of being at the home of one of my oldest heroes and one of my favorite people in the world, Wendell Berry, in Port Royal, and to spend the night with him, and then to spend the day happily tramping through the woods around his farm and looking at Shumard oaks and chinkapin oaks and white oaks and every other kind of oak, some of which we don't even have where I am, was a great pleasure. And to sense the depth of his love for Kentucky, a love all the deeper for being deeply knowledgeable, was remarkable. And I wonder sometimes if Kentucky understands quite the reverence with which he is held in the rest of the world. I think he's on anybody's short list of the greatest writers at work in the English language, and at the very top of my list. And when we see from a distance the brave things that he is doing, including having to go and sit in the office of your governor last spring to bring attention to mountaintop removal mining, one hopes that people here are taking seriously that moral witness, because people around the rest of the country and the world are taking it very seriously and understand what a prophet he is, and one hopes with honor in his own country. I'm going to talk very briefly to you about this issue that ties together coal and gas and oil, this issue that is the most important issue of our time, the one that all those students were so focused on this morning, because its outcome will determine what their lives will be like, those who have another 70 years or so to go on this planet, and that is this issue of climate change. It is by far the biggest thing that human beings have ever done to this planet. For the 10,000 years of human civilization, we existed in what the scientists call the Holocene, a period of remarkable climatic stability that underwrote the rise of that civilization. In the lifetimes of the people in this room, the Holocene has come to an end, and we have moved on to something else. The temperature has begun to rise. So far, we've raised the temperature of the Earth about 1 degree. We trap about 0.75 watt of extra solar energy per square meter of the Earth's surface, thanks to all the carbon dioxide we've poured into the atmosphere by burning coal and gas and oil. On these questions, science is completely clear. In fact, there was a very interesting story that some of you may have seen last week. One scientist who had on the very, very, very slim ranks of skeptical scientists left rounded up a large sum of money, including from some of the opponents of action on energy, people like the Koch brothers, and offered to do a study that would look at all the temperature records and try to disprove the notion that the planet was warming and that we were behind it. And this scientist at Berkeley published his results last week, and he said in an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal, "I am skeptic no longer. The scientists who've been saying this for 20 years have it exactly right. The evidence is no longer confined to science. It's all around us for anyone with eyes to see. Because warm air holds more water vapor than cold, the atmosphere is about 4% moister than it was 40 years ago. That loads the dice both for drought and for flood, and place after place has been throwing snake eyes. We've seen just in the last year absolutely unprecedented drought and heat wave in places like Russia, or at the moment in Texas, where they are in the middle of a drought deeper than the drought of the Dust Bowl. The head of the Texas Forest Firefighting Service said a few weeks ago, as fires swept across the suburbs of Austin, no human being has ever had to fight fire in conditions like this. And he was right. The humidity approached zero, the temperature was higher than it had ever been. It was a conflagration. Once that water has evaporated into the atmosphere, water vapor molecules only on average stay up there 6 or 7 days, so they're coming down. And that means that deluge and downpour and flood have become far more common in the statistical record and with far more devastating result. Last year, it was Pakistan, where epic flooding put something like 1/4 of the country underwater and left 20 million people homeless. In Christmas time last year, it was Queensland in Australia. Then it was along the Mississippi and Missouri. In Vermont, where I live, we got our taste a few weeks ago when the tail end of Hurricane Irene dropped more rain than had ever been measured on our state. And there were covered bridges there that had stood for 200 years, taking everything nature could throw at them, and they just washed away down the rivers. It is rack and ruin there. Today, as we sit here eating, people in Bangkok, one of the biggest cities in the world, are scrambling desperately to figure out how to avoid the surging floodwaters washing through the middle of that great city, cradle of Buddhist civilization. If you don't want to believe scientists and you don't want to believe your own eyes, ask the people in our economy that we ask to analyze risk. The insurance industry, risk specialists, have been loud and strong in their proclamation that we need to take this problem very seriously. Munich Re, the biggest insurer in the world, in its annual report last December said there is no possible way to explain the surge we see in catastrophe around the world and the payouts that go with it except by invoking climate change. That's what is going on. And hence, there's finally beginning to be the rise of the kind of movement that we needed long ago to begin demanding real action on these subjects. With a number of college students. I've worked over the last few years to build this movement called 350.org that takes its odd name from what the scientists tell us is the most carbon we can safely have in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million, a number, sadly, that we already exceed by a large margin. The air outside today is 393 parts per million CO2, no matter where you are. It is rising by 2 parts per million per year as we burn ever more coal and gas and oil. And that's why Pakistan drowns and Texas burns, you know. That movement, especially with young people around the world, has caught on in a major way. We've organized about 15,000 rallies in every country on Earth except North Korea. CNN referred to it as the most widespread political activity in the planet's history. It's been great fun to watch and very moving to watch because, of course, many of the people that we are working with around the world are in countries that have done nothing to contribute to this problem, whose consumption of fossil fuel is so small as to be a rounding error in the calculations. And that they are willing to work with those of us who have caused this problem is always, to me, moving and powerful. It is the same kind of solidarity that one sees around the, say, Rotarian network across the world. Wonderful as those movements are, there are also moments when things need to become more pointed and more political and sharper. And we are in one of those right now, and I'll spend just a couple of minutes telling you about it because you will be hearing more on the news in the next few days. At the moment, there is a major fight underway about a pipeline that will run from the tar sands of northern Alberta down to the Gulf of Mexico if President Obama grants the permit allowing its construction. Many of us have come out strongly against this pipeline, and by many of us, I mean most of the nation's top scientists in letters to the president, the last 10 winners of the Nobel Peace Prize, except for Barack Obama, so the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu and a number of other great people, a very widespread coalition that has included the largest civil disobedience action in this country in about 35 years. It was very civil disobedience, I must say. 1,253 people were arrested in August outside the White House, and a few of them are your fellow citizens of Louisville who are here with us today, and I'm very grateful to them for that witness. It was not an easy thing for any of us to do, and yet it managed to take this issue and give it the national attention that it deserves, if for no other reason than that tar sands in Alberta is the second largest pool of carbon on Earth, second only to the oil fields of Saudi Arabia. It was burning those oil fields, more than anything else, that raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree. But when we began doing that, we had no idea about climate change. If knowing what we now know, we encounter the next Saudi Arabia and do exactly the same thing, then we are not acting wisely, we are acting rashly. And there is no argument worth that kind of risk, although even the arguments that people have advanced for this pipeline turn out to be weak. It will create a few jobs in its construction, by best estimate, about 3,000. But those will, of course, be temporary. The point of a pipeline is no one really has to work to keep it going once it's built. And it will come at the price of delaying, for a while longer, the transition, job-rich transition that we need to make to a green energy economy. When we get serious about that, we will find the next driver of our economy, because the kind of the scale of work that needs to be done to weatherize homes and to put solar panels on their roofs and things is enormous. And it's work that must be done here. None of you, I wager, will put your house on a boat and ship it to China in order to get it well insulated. That work will be done close to home. And that is a good thing in a place that needs lots of jobs, especially for people who are good at swinging hammers and who are not going to find work in the construction industry, at least in the numbers that they did before our housing crash, you know? This is the next piece of work. It's also very important case, this pipeline, for people who are interested in good and clean government. When the State Department set out to do an environmental review of this project, they behaved in a way that made it a kind of poster child for what people at, say, Occupy Wall Street are complaining about, and something that we should all be complaining about, regardless of our partisan position. The State Department asked the company in question, TransCanada Pipeline, who they would like to review their pipeline. TransCanada Pipeline submitted a list of three companies, and the State Department helpfully chose the top name on the list, a company called Entrix. When people did careful investigative reporting, i.e., when they clicked on the website of Entrix, what they found was that one of their five major clients was TransCanada Pipeline. In essence, this company was reviewing itself in the kind of back-scratching way that we cannot afford, either economically or environmentally. And so we have been calling as hard as we can on the president to send this back for a real review, to demand that it be treated with the seriousness that it deserves. And on Sunday, there will be thousands of us surrounding the White House, trying to circle it as best we can. And we'll be carrying nothing but quotations from Barack Obama in 2008. Beautiful words. It's time for us to end the tyranny of oil. In my administration, the rise of the oceans will begin to slow and the planet will begin to heal. I'm going to run the most transparent government in history. Those were important things to say. They spoke to a generation. It is no wonder that young people supported him in absolutely record numbers, because he was enunciating the vision of people who have to live on this planet for a long time yet to come. And if he, well, if he didn't mean those things, he shouldn't have said them, because a lot of people believed him. And we need him now to stand up for those words. And that's why we'll be there on Sunday. The thing I want to say, just to finish here, is when people talk about political protest or about civil disobedience or about any of these things, there is a kind of reflex idea in our society that this must somehow be a sort of radical thing that people are engaged in. And I wish to argue just the opposite. When people were arrested this August, the one thing that we told everybody as they were coming was we didn't want to see them unless they were wearing a necktie or they were wearing a dress, okay? Because we wanted a visual way to get across the truth. We're not radicals in this situation. Radicals are people who are willing to alter the chemical composition of the atmosphere. That makes, you know, oil company executives radicals. In pursuit of their ends, they are willing to alter the chemical composition of the one atmosphere that we have in ways that scientists have assured us will be dangerous. And in that context, those of us who are merely trying to keep the world in something like the shape we found it when we were born are conservatives and deep conservatives. And that is the strain, I think, that is coming to the fore now as we enter one of the most difficult chapters in our history. And it is very appropriate that the Festival of Faiths has taken this topic of air, sacred air, as its theme this year. That air is the one thing that unites all of us around this planet. And it is the essential bottom line for everybody's life, from the first breath that they take to the last breath that they take. There is nothing more important than trying to figure out how to keep that air operating in the way that it always has, surrounding us with all the benefits of creation, allowing us to live on a world that is mostly benign and entirely beautiful. And we are up to that challenge, but it's going to take people becoming active and engaged on the most important questions that we face. And that is why it is such a pleasure for me to get to be with you here today, to thank you for all the work you do as Rotarians and for all the work you do in your community, and to say that we need that same kind of level of civic engagement on a planetary level as well. Wonderful a place as Louisville is, it can thrive only on a planet that is thriving as well. And so this work is all of our work in every part of the world. Thank you very much.
Very good, Bill. Bill is accepted to take a few questions.
Thank you very much for speaking today. I have two questions. One is, do you own an automobile? And the second one is, do you have any faith that in the next 10 or 15 years there will be a technological breakthrough, either solar or nuclear, that will end the tyranny of oil and coal?
Sure. I do own an automobile. In fact, I was very glad to drive over with Christy and discover that we own exactly the same one, a Honda Civic Hybrid. 50 miles to the gallon, and I'm looking forward to the plug-in hybrid that's coming a year or two down the road, because they're getting about 200 miles to the gallon, and that's a good thing. And it's an example of the fact that we already have much of the technology, to get to your second question, that we need to end this tyranny of oil and of fossil fuel in general. Our problem is not lack of technology, it's lack of political will to put it to use. Part of that is coming to grips with the fact that we need to charge the fossil fuel industry for the damage that they do to the environment. Carbon should carry a price that reflects that damage, okay? And the minute that it does, then all the other alternatives will instantly be cost-effective by comparison. The fossil fuel industry are pretty much the only industry that has the sweetheart deal where they are allowed to use the atmosphere as an open sewer into which to dump their largest waste product, carbon dioxide, for free. Okay? And when that comes to an end, then a level playing field will quickly, through the magic of the market, provide us with much of what we need. Now, even without that happening, the amazing thing is there's already lots of work going on with smart entrepreneurs. I'll tell you one story. I was in China recently doing a big piece for the National Geographic on China and energy, all right? Now, China is doing many things wrong. They're building lots of coal-fired power plants. They're also doing many things right. And one of them is installing quickly lots of renewable energy, especially cheap stuff that's easy to put up. Half of the world's installed renewable capacity is solar hot water heaters in China. This is very simple technology on the roof. I've had it for many years. The payback time is a year or two, okay? In China, in this country, less than 1% of people get their domestic hot water from solar panels on the roof. In China, that number is about a quarter. 250 million Chinese, when they take a shower at night, the water is, hot water is coming from solar panels on the roof. So I spent a great day with the CEO of that corporation, also the engineer who had developed some of these things, a wonderful man, and now, by the way, a very rich man. and he, we had a good day, and then in the end of the day, he took me into his, he said, come into my little museum here, a little private museum next to his office. And he had sort of busts of great world leaders and things, but pride of place in this museum was a solar hot water panel, okay? And it was a kind of shabby looking older one, and I said, you know what that is? I had no idea. He said, that's one of the solar hot water panels that Jimmy Carter installed on the White House in 1979 and Ronald Reagan took down in 1985, okay? And he said, you guys owned this technology. You owned it lock, stock, and barrel 30 some years ago. And I suppose he said I should be glad that you abandon it and let me be the one to get rich off it. But as a father and as a citizen of the world, I wish to heck you would get your act together and start catching up with us. And that's, I think, a sort of useful example of where we are technologically and where we aren't.
John? I can sort of remember in the early 30s, we had the hot summers that were hotter than we're having now, and we didn't have any air conditioning. But there was a scientist on the radio recently that said that there were sunspots that we were going to have for about six more years, and that after they were gone, then the weather would go back like it used to be.
The people have tried, you know how the scientific method works, right? Someone advances a hypothesis, and everyone else does their best to shoot it down. So that's that very powerful dialectic. So 25 years ago or so, our foremost climate scientists advanced the strong hypothesis that carbon dioxide, whose molecular structure we know traps heat, was now trapping enough of it that we could notice it, that that signal was visible above what an engineer would call the noise, the static in the system. And ever since then, in an effort to kind of, within that dialectic, to challenge that, people have brought up one possibility after another: sunspots, cosmic rays. There are six or seven things that have been tried and found wanting. The best evidence is that at least 90% of the observed warming of that extra degree that we've raised the temperature is the result of human emission of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. We know it particularly in relation to the sun because we have very careful records of how much energy the sun is putting out at any given moment, the level of solar irradiance. And it's actually gone down somewhat over the last couple of decades. If the sun were driving this change, it would actually be getting marginally, probably imperceptibly, cooler over that period.
I've been a long time in the squatting position. I'm starting to feel like I'm not quite as young as I used to be. Knowing that the people in this room will not be moved unless it affects their wallet or affects their life, I would like for you to predict to me what it will take for the world, not just Louisville, to stand up and say enough is enough.
Well, the world is beginning to do that. Mother Nature, sadly, is going to provide us a kind of infinite series of teachable moments as we advance further into this crisis, and it's easy to see them taking place. Even within, say, Texas, over the last year, the polling about global warming has begun to shift perceptibly because people notice that it hasn't rained for a year and it's been unbelievably hot, hotter than it's ever been. So that's part of the answer. The other part of the answer is individual people beginning to act. I can make an endless argument to you about how this is going to affect your wallet and what the insurance companies can tell you and what it means to try and, you know, repair a state like Vermont, how much it costs to put together your roadways and things again, and on and on and on. But it almost seems beside the point. We will make this change or we won't make it when we understand that at root this is a moral issue that we face here. And the moral issue is about whether we owe anything to the rest of the world and to the rest of creation and to the rest of all the generations that are going to come after us. And if we can't bring ourselves to muster some feeling for all those things, then nothing I tell you about your wallet is or should make any real difference in the end. This is a test, in a sense, this biggest thing we've ever faced, of whether the big brain was such a smart adaptation or not, you know? And we're going to find out. We're going to find out, in essence, whether that big brain is attached to a big enough heart to make some difference or not. And that's why it's such a pleasure to be here, particularly for this Festival of Faith, because that's one of the forums in which we need to be talking about these things, really need to be talking about them.
Miles, you got the last question.
Would you bring us up to date on the economics of solar power? Ray Kurzweil has said it would be economic with any other form of power by 2020. I think we're getting there fairly rapidly, are we not?
Yes, we're getting very close to the point where solar power is economically competitive, even with the enormous subsidy that we provide the fossil fuel industry, and even though we do not charge them for the damage that they do to the atmosphere. Our problem is that even as those prices become competitive, we don't need just a kind of slow, steady replacement of one form of power with another. The timeline defined by chemistry and physics requires that we make a very quick and very powerful switch, that we've got to turn some things off before their economically useful life is over and turn some other things on. And especially we have to be able to do this in the developing world. Because we filled the atmosphere getting rich in this world, we owe something in both practical and moral terms to the rest of the world. And the easiest and smartest way to pay that debt would be to figure out how to transfer technology, allowing them to leapfrog over the fossil fuel age. Too late at this point in certain ways for China, though China's doing good things. Not too late for India and for much of the rest of the world. And this is one of the really deep tests that we face at this point, whether we can rise to that standard or not. And I don't know what the answer will be. This is one of the reasons that international climate negotiations have been so bedeviled and gotten so tangled up. And it will take some political leadership and courage in this country above all others to break that logjam. It is very hard to convince people in the developing world to do things that are, at least for the moment, more expensive than burning coal when they know that burning coal is how we got rich and when they know that they have deep, pressing daily problems of poverty. It is a horrible pinch to put countries like India in. Do we solve the immediate daily problems that we face of deep poverty at the cost within the next few years, as they well understand, of flooding our low-lying areas, melting the glaciers that water the Ganges, on and on and on? It is not a bind that they should be put in or that they need to be. We do have enough technological know-how and enough wealth left on this planet to allow people to make that transition. It's a matter of political will, and it's what we're trying desperately as we fight these pipelines, as we work at 350.org, all those things to muster up. It is not a partisan battle. It's not an ideological battle. It's a battle about what science is telling us about the future. It is a battle between the pull of the present, which is always strong, and the pull of the future, which we need to be able to feel inside us. And if we do, then we will make those changes in the time that we have. Thank you all.